Tell you what, it has been a week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Friday today, the 23rd day of September. I do believe, good as always, to have you along, everybody. I'm not going to lie. We've got way too much to talk about, way not enough time. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you. Obviously, we will talk about the Fed meeting and the rise in interest rates and Chair Powell's press conference, at which he said... And this is pretty close to a quote that we're looking at, and he needs, kind of, is what he said, a sustained period of below trend growth. Interpret that for me, would you? It's him saying we're not really going to get a soft landing, are we?
Right. It's him saying at any rate, the landing is going to be bumpy and it might just be rough, you know. So I think that what you can take away from that is we are definitely going to have growth that feels a lot weaker than what we've gotten used to in the last couple of years. What that practically means for people sort of living out their lives on the ground is fewer customers coming in the door, restaurants and shops, and likely less hiring going on at local businesses, and in all likelihood, weaker wage gains. You know, those are sort of the things that the Fed is trying to engineer. Like when we talk about below trend growth and all these fancy economic terms, effectively what that means is fewer job opportunities, less wage growth, and that allows demand to cool down and sets the stage for lower price increases. So certainly a painful adjustment period here.
Do you think, Kay Davidson, that after his Jackson Hole speech and then the press conference that he gave on Wednesday, when he, I mean, so Gina asked the first question and Powell said, I'll answer your question in a minute, but first, and he literally read a statement in which he said, I'm really, really serious. We're going to go at this as long as we can till inflation is dead. Again, I paraphrase. Do you think people believe him now?
I think that they do. I was going to say, I think Jay, I wonder if Jay Powell's been to Toastmasters. Like, it seems like the speeches have gotten super sharp, right? It's become much more clear. I'm just kidding. The Fed has a wonderful, you know, really group of people that know what they're doing and how to deliver a speech. Obviously, the communications team there. But I mean, really, I think that he's made a very concerted effort to just be much clearer, much shorter, much more direct and to the point. Nick Timiraos at the Journal, my former colleague, had a story too saying that Powell had a draft of a speech for Jackson Hole, and he ripped it up and essentially even shorter and clearer to just make it very, you know, as clear as can be. I mean it, guys. I really mean it. We're not going to back off until the job is done. And he said something like that we're going to keep at it, which, you know, keeping at it was the title of Paul Volcker's memoir. So I think that that's intentional as well. There's a lot of messaging, and the message is we mean business.
It's worth pointing out here, Gina Smilek, that you're writing a book on the Federal Reserve, the history of the Fed, right?
I am.
Okay.
Yep.
It's also worth pointing out here that Paul Volcker in the late 70s, early 80s did, in fact, back off a little bit and things got ugly very quickly.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that's a really interesting history. So my book called Limitless out in February actually has this whole history in it. I have to put my plug in.
No,
but,
gotta
yeah,
get it.
So I think that the history here is really interesting. Paul Volcker backed off temporarily. That was really sort of a function of the way he had chosen to communicate policy, unfortunately. I think the bigger mistake came actually before that. We had about a decade of relatively high inflation, and the Fed consistently just didn't put the brakes on hard enough. They would raise rates, see a little bit of economic pain and kind of like pull back, lower rates, let things get out of hand for a couple more years and then try again. And so we basically went through two cycles of that before Volcker came in. And so that allowed inflation to become just part of everyday life. It was definitely part of the psychology back then. If you read through like old newspaper clippings, you could just see that the way people talk about inflation assumes that it's going to be around for forever. And that was the problem because, you know, when Paul Volcker came in, he really had to do some very painful economic things before inflation came down. And so I think that's the lesson we're learning from now. And that is what the Fed is very afraid of repeating.
Let me, Kate, turn to the politics of this for like a nanosecond here. And I don't want to just talk to the politics. I want you to talk to the economics of it. But Chair Powell is under pressure from progressives let me rephrase that, right? Chair Powell is being criticized for cracking down on inflation because it's going to hurt some people. And my question to you is, what is he supposed to do? Let inflation go cray-cray?
I know it's such a kind of perplexing debate, and I had the same question myself. And I think you probably remember when Senator Elizabeth Warren
Right.
wrote the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. It, I guess, was a couple months ago now, with a lot of criticism, but very little in the way of, you know, here's what we should be doing instead. And I think that there are groups out there, some progressive groups, and but even some moderate groups, who are calling on fiscal policymakers in the White House to do more. The problem is, as we've talked about before, those kinds of tools don't work as well as what the Fed is doing. It's just, unfortunately, what the Fed only has one tool, and as Gina said, it's very painful. It just cracks down on demand. So can the White House do more? Yes, but you need kind of a lot of those little things to really make much of a difference. And as we know, Washington does not move very quickly. It's very hard to get everyone on the same page. So that's why the job is with the Fed.
Cray-cray, by the way, is probably not an approved official economic journalist term, but that's a whole different thing. Okay,
Gina, we'll allow
thank you very much. Gina, reasonably quickly here, can we talk the global circumstance here for a minute? Because as you wrote yesterday, and as we've all seen this week, globally central banks, except for the Bank of Japan, are doing exactly what the Fed is doing. Why does that matter, and why could that be a challenge?
Yeah, so we have a lot of central banks fighting inflation or trying to keep up with the Fed, one of those two things,
right,
all at the same time, lots of rate increases. And so the reason that that matters so much is we know that these rate increases take a long time to be fully felt. So we are doing a ton of tightening all over the world simultaneously, very quickly, and not giving it any time to sort of play out. So, you know, this obviously we all are paying more for mortgages and more for car loans now, but a year from now, we're going to be feeling this all through the economy as those full effects take hold, maybe 2 years from now. And that could be a really painful result. And so I think that's the thing that you're increasingly hearing economists warning about is we might sort of, you know, discover that we've overdone this about a mile after we've passed our exit on the highway. And so I think the question is just, you know, when will we get a full glimpse of that? And the answer is yet to be determined.
Gina Smilek at the New York Times, Kate Davidson at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend at the end of a very, very busy week on Wall Street today. So look, you don't actually have to check your retirement account every day. You know, you really don't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Forget oil for a minute, forget gas for a minute, the kind we put in our cars, and let's talk nat gas for a minute here, can we? Natural gas futures have been falling. They're 25% or so lower than they were just a week ago. The Energy Department says inventories are way higher than we'd thought. The question, though, is why? Marketplace's Justin Ho has the answer.
Let's start with an explosion. Okay, that's the sound of Helm's Deep blowing up in the Lord of the Rings movie. The explosion I'm talking about happened in June at a liquefied natural gas export facility in Freeport, Texas. No one was hurt, but...
That facility uses about 2% of U.S. gas supply.
Jacques Rousseau is managing director at Clearview Energy Partners.
And so that gas has been redirected in the market, and it has not been shipped overseas.
The weather also hasn't been as hot lately. Less demand for AC means less demand for natural gas to generate electricity, says Eugene Kim at Wood Mackenzie.
All this is occurring while supply, U.S. gas production, is at record levels.
Production is up because prices have been relatively high. Anna Mikulska at Rice University says the supply buildup is a good sign for consumers.
That hopefully means that if we do have cold winter, we will have storage filled to the point that it won't give us trouble or at least won't impact our prices too much.
It might not be good news for Europe, which really needs natural gas to replace the supply from Russia. Mikulska says that's because the U.S. is already liquefying and exporting as much as possible.
Just as U.S. is constrained with infrastructure when it comes to export of LNG, Europe is also constrained by infrastructure to import LNG.
Mikulska says Europe's natural gas supplies might not last through the winter. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There are a few things more valuable to a farmer anywhere, obviously, but especially out here in the western United States, and especially now in the sustained drought we're having. There are a few things more valuable than water. And when there's not enough to go around, figuring out whose water use matters most, well, those discussions get heated in a hurry. Caleb Radel from the Mountain West News Bureau has that story.
It's a hot summer morning in Diamond Valley, Nevada, and hay farmer Marty Plaskett is standing next to an irrigation pivot, a large rotating sprinkler system at ground level that's watering his green alfalfa field.
This water here is spraying mainly in the crop canopy, so it's spraying directly to the ground.
These low-elevation sprinklers reduce his water use and waste. For years, Plaskett used elevated sprinklers that sprayed more plants at once. Sometimes colorful rainbows would show up in the mist, a sight Plaskett used to enjoy. He can't anymore.
Now it makes me sick to my stomach because any water that's leaving by evaporation, it's going up in the air. It's the worst thing to see water drifting anymore.
And this valley can't afford to waste any water. For decades, water use in Diamond Valley was so high, it caused groundwater levels to drop by an average of 2 feet every year. And without water,
your land value is zero. You have no livelihood. See you later. So that wasn't an option for us.
Faced with that threat, farmers got together in an attempt to shoulder the burden. They were able to do that because the state declared Diamond Valley a critical management area. The farmers had 10 years to put together a groundwater management plan. If they didn't succeed, the state could turn off at least half of the farmers' wells. Local officials said that would cripple the county's economy, which brings in more than $22 million a year from farming. Jake Tibbetts oversees the county's Natural Resources Department.
We're taking water out much quicker than it's being replenished by Mother Nature. So that becomes the big issue here, is it's something that we can't continue on that path forever.
So Tibbetts helped develop a plan that was approved by most of the valley's water users and later greenlit by the state. It required all irrigators to reduce their use over time. That's a drastic change from how most water law functions in the West, says Philip Womble with the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University.
The prevailing system for allocating water in the Western United States is known as prior appropriation, and this is a priority-based system where older, more senior water rights get their entire water allocation before newer, more junior water users get any water.
That's why not everyone is in favor of Diamond Valley's new plan, especially those farmers with senior water rights. They sued to keep the groundwater plan from moving forward. One plaintiff was cattle operation Sadler Ranch. Manager Levi Shoda says those rights shouldn't be messed with.
We see water rights as a private property right. And when you start taking private property rights and giving them to some, like reallocating them to somebody else, I think you're crossing a line.
Despite legal challenges, the Nevada Supreme Court upheld the contested plan in a 4-3 ruling this June. A request for a rehearing was denied late this summer. Now, the new plan is on track to begin next irrigation season, starting in the spring of 2023. Back on the hay farm, Plaskett says he knows there's no guarantee that this plan will work, but the farmers had to try something to protect their futures.
It's just the need to have the long-term vision. I mean, it's not about me. It's about our kids or whoever comes next.
Next spring, Diamond Valley farmers and ranchers as a whole have to reduce their groundwater pumping by 3%. By year 10 of the plan, they'll have to cut back pumping by 30%. I'm Caleb Radel for Marketplace.
Coming up,
wolves, werewolves, and Rougarou.
Oh my, comics and publishing is scary stuff, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's, maybe not just for the day, but for the whole week. Dow Industrial is down 486 today. The blue chip's off 800 at one point. 1.6% was the close to the negative. New low for the year, 29,590. The NASDAQ down 198 points, 1.8%, 10,867. Numbers get confusing sometimes, right? S&P 500 down 64 points, 1.7%, 36.93 for the week. As I said, the Dow off 3.99%, the NASDAQ down 5%, S&P 500 off 4.6%. I think it's down 23% for the year thus far today. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.68%. Remember that number. It'll be relevant later on. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, quick, what is the challenge facing streaming companies right now? Well, yes, subscriber numbers maybe, but I'm thinking something more fundamental. How about content, that thing whence subscribers come, right? Saw a story in the Wall Street Journal today along those lines that Netflix is going to change the way it pays some stand-up comics for those specials that it runs. Basically, instead of buying the special outright for a big lump sum, Netflix is going to rent it for a couple of years and then give it back to the comedian. We called Netflix to ask what's up. They said this is just a, quote, additional alternative pathway for comedians to work with Netflix in response to the current market. Current market, of course, doing a whole lot of work there. Back when it was growing its subscriber base, Netflix spent a bundle on comedians like Dave Chappelle and Ali Wong, not to mention nine-figure deals for showrunners like Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy. So, does that model work in the current market, shall we say, where Netflix is losing subscribers? Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Back in 2017, when Netflix lured Shonda Rhimes away from the broadcast world for streaming, the strategy wasn't just about acquiring new hit dramas like Bridgerton. It was about making you think Netflix was synonymous with new hit dramas like Bridgerton. Michael Smith teaches marketing at Carnegie Mellon.
What Netflix did was really smart in terms of paying a bunch of showrunners and a bunch of talent to create original Netflix programming that then built Netflix's brand.
Wall Street was fine with that. Netflix kept inking big name talent, the subscribers kept rolling in, you kept binge watching Stranger Things, everyone was happy. But if Netflix made a nine-figure Shonda Rhimes type deal right now, Wall Street would have some questions, says Bank of America analyst Nat Schindler.
I think Wall Street would look at it very skeptically. People are looking for them to actually cut spend.
For a while there, Netflix really cornered the prestige streaming TV market and the talent that created it. But now it has deep-pocketed competition. Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, Apple. Charles Schrager at NYU says serialized dramas are really the bread and butter of streaming, which means we'll still be seeing news of nine-figure deals for the people who create the popular ones.
There is a dearth. There's a shortage. You don't manufacture those people.
Wonder if this is a good time to dust off my spec script. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Sure, Matt, sure. The King of Beers is going to be non-alcoholic at the World Cup this year. Soccer's big tournament starts in November in Qatar, where alcohol is legal, but is restricted in public spaces like stadiums. So Budweiser's taken the opportunity to showcase its non-alcoholic offering, Budweiser Zero. Company, it seems, has big plans for no and low alcohol products, wants to grow them from 6 to 20% of its global volume in the next couple of years. Budweiser's global volume is obviously huge, so that 20% is a big number. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on how the non-alcohol market is changing.
You've got your non-alcoholic beers, craft ones now too, faux champagnes, mock mezcals, phony Negronis, and cute little single-serving bottles. I mean, when there's a New York Times wire cutter guide, you know something's having a moment.
I tasted 69 non-alcoholic drinks, so there really is something for everyone.
Anna Perling wrote Wirecutter's Guide. She's now a reviews editor at Forbes Vetted. She was partial to Figlia Fiore, a bright red aperitif.
It is great and super tangy. I like it on its own with some ice or some seltzer.
At ZeroProofNation.com, Laura Silverman tracks the expanding bevy of non-alcoholic beverages, which weren't around when she quit drinking about 10 years ago.
At the time, it felt like my life was over. There was no social. There was no, like, you can't do anything in your 20s
Now, she says, health-conscious young people are increasingly sober curious, and they're willing to spend on specialty drinks that help them celebrate or unwind, says Caleb Bryant, a beverage industry analyst with Mintel.
Consumers are wanting premium substitutes to alcohol, something that looks and maybe even tastes like an alcoholic beverage, but are a healthier alternative.
He says these brands could suffer if the economy slows and sends consumers looking for value. Club soda and lime, anyone? I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
You know this, if you've been to a physical bookstore the past couple of years, it has been a bumpy time in books. I guess you know it if you've ordered books online too, lots of books just not available or they're printing delayed. That happened because demand for print books spiked early in the pandemic, just as the business of making those books got super complicated by a paper shortage and various and sundry supply chain problems of which we have discussed at length. And so publishers, authors, and readers just had to wait. So as we approach a big time for books, I mean, how many books have you gotten over holidays past, right? Marketplace's Savannah Marr checks in with one local bookseller in New Mexico for a read on how things are going.
On a retail block in downtown Albuquerque, Red Planet Books and Comics stands out. There's a colorful outer space scene painted on its storefront, like the cover of a sci-fi graphic novel. And store manager Aaron Cuffey says there's something else unique about the shop.
This is the most comprehensive and arguably most impressive display of native comics anywhere in the world.
Like one of its newest titles, called A Howl.
Themed all around wolves, werewolves, and Rougarou.
Rougarou, that's a shape-shifting monster that shows up in stories from Métis communities in Canada.
Selling like hotcakes, I just shipped out 12 of them today.
To customers who've been waiting for this book. It was supposed to debut over a year ago, but its publisher, Lee Francis, says that didn't pan out.
It just kept getting pushed back further and further.
All the way to spring of 2022. Francis co-owns Red Planet Books. He also runs a small publishing company called Native Realities Press that's had to adjust to printing bottlenecks, caused in part by the early pandemic paper shortage. Francis says the specialty paper needed to print comics and graphic novels has been especially hard to find.
It's just made us adjust our timing. So mostly now, just straight out the gate, we are looking at, you know, when we start pre-sales, that it's going to be 3 months.
For that werewolf anthology, the delays stretched past what would have been an important retail window between Native American Heritage Month and the holidays. Kristen McLean, an analyst with NPD BookScan, says it wasn't the only casualty.
The worst case scenarios were happening. So you were seeing things like books that were specifically tied to holidays not make it into the stores in time.
And if you're the author or publisher of a Halloween picture book that didn't go to print until December, McLean says you took a big financial hit. Ahead of this holiday shopping season, McLean says some of those supply chain snags are smoothing out, and the industry is adapting to the ones that aren't.
Printers in the U.S. are at capacity. Publishers are having to change their expectations about how long it takes to get a book made.
For retailers, that means tempering customers' expectations, says Aaron Cuffey at Red Planet Books and Comics.
You know, it being especially important for us to let people know, hey, we ordered the books for you, or we ordered the books for the store, but we just got a note from the publisher or the distributor, they won't be here for 6 months.
Red Planet started ordering holiday inventory in August this year to make sure it has plenty on its shelves. It's encouraging customers to get their gift orders in early too, just to be safe. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which trickle-down economics crosses the Atlantic Ocean. The new chancellor of the Exchequer over in the UK, that's their Treasury Secretary, his name is Kwasi Kwarteng. He unveiled Prime Minister Liz Truss's economic plan today. Payroll and income tax cuts skewed to the top end of the income spectrum, a freeze on corporate taxes, tens of billions of dollars in energy bill subsidies over the next 2 years. Suffice it to say, investors were not reassured. The yield on 10-year UK government notes, GILT, they're called, by the way, G-I-L-T-S, 3.76%. Remember the U.S. 10-year? 3.68. So interesting over there. Buyers are demanding a premium to fund what will soon be rising government debt. All right, we're out of here, but your moment of economic context obviously comes first. One more item from London, the British pound. $1.08 is what sterling cost you today. $1.08. That $1.15 that I found so surprising the other day, that was so 10 days ago. You guys, come on. Oh, man. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.